The air was full of politics. President Lyndon Johnson had announced that he was not a candidate for re-election. I had just been to Pittsburgh to address the steelworkers, where they had put on a massive demonstration urging me to be a candidate for president. And to say the least, I was bubbling with enthusiasm over the possibility of being a candidate for the president, for the presidency. So insofar as I was personally concerned, this was to be quite a night. The audience was enthusiastic, and it was filled with my friends. We had a sumptuous dinner, and we're just getting into the program when someone came up to me and handed me a note. And on the note it read, "It is reported that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has been shot while in Memphis, Tennessee." I turned to the man that brought the note and said, "Is this a rumor or has it been confirmed?" And he said, "I don't know. But this is what we've heard." I asked him to double check it immediately. I left the platform to go backstage and got a hold of Glenn Weaver, the chief of my Secret Service detail, and asked him, for goodness sakes, to please check at once to see whether or not the story was true or just a rumor. I returned to my place at the table, and within a very few moments, Mr. Weaver came up to me and said, "The story is true. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has been assassinated." It was as if the lights had gone out and that the ceiling had come crashing down. The whole evening, was erased. All of the gaiety, festivity, the politics, the mingling of people, the chatter, the noise of conversation, all of it seemed to be erased from my mind as I sat there wondering just now what to do. So I decided that something had to be done because there were rumors sweeping because the news was beginning to sweep across the floor of the banquet hall. So I arose and, filled with and gripped with emotion and sorrow, announced to the audience that one of America's great leaders, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., had been killed. Norman, at this point, I will get the actual remarks of what I said because I believe they're scratched out on a piece of paper. As I sat at the table, I tried to gather my thoughts, and I jotted them down on the back of an envelope. I arose and looked at the audience, and with eyes filled with tears, and my voice gripped with emotion, announced that Dr. Martin Luther King had been shot. I suggested that the evening be brought to a conclusion, that this was no time for further festivity, and I asked the chaplain of the House of Representatives to come forth and to lead us in prayer. Following the prayer, the audience disbanded, and the audience disbanded and went home. It was very evident as people left that great banquet hall, that America was in for an incredible period of suffering, grief, and tragedy. Immediately, as the word spread across the land, the black communities in city after city were up in arms. Whole areas of great cities were ignited and set afire. The torch was put to one section after another of Detroit, of Washington, D.C. A mixture of grief and sorrow, of anger and bitterness flashed across the land like an atom bomb. America was in deep trouble. Not only had one of her sons been slain, and a man of nonviolence and yet deep dedication, but the black people felt that their leader had been taken from them, and they struck back with fury and rage. They burned the areas in which they lived. They broke into the stores and engaged in looting and pillage. There was no controlling the conflagration. It seemed as if America was going up in smoke and fire. At this very moment, the black leadership called upon their people to refrain from violence and rioting and burning. Reverend Ralph Abernathy succeeded Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as the leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The nation prepared to pay its final respects and honors to Dr. King, to Martin Luther King Jr. I flew to Atlanta, Georgia, where I represented the president in our nation, where Muriel and I represented the president in our nation at the funeral. I shall never forget coming down the street that led to the little Baptist church where Dr. King had served as pastor. I recall visiting with his beloved father and mother, who were good friends of mine, and of meeting and of talking to Dr. King's wife, Coretta, and their children. I remember so well being received by a young leader, a young minister, and leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference by the name of Andrew Young. He always seemed to me to be so strong, so sincere, and so truly dedicated to the principles of nonviolence and peaceful political action. That young man who served as one of Dr. Martin Luther King's lieutenants is today a member of Congress from Atlanta, and is serving with a great ability and effectiveness in the House of Representatives. I have come to know him not only as a fellow legislator, but as a friend. So out of that tragedy and hour of sorrow came a rewarding experience for me to be just a little closer to one of the brilliant and dedicated young leaders that had worked side by side with Martin Luther King Jr. As I was saying, I recall riding down the streets with to the funeral. Every inch of the sidewalk was packed. Every place that you looked, there were people. It was like two great walls of humanity on each side of the street, pushing out from the curb literally into the street as the cars edged their way on. I was taken into the church through the back door, because the church was filled to overflowing. And I was seated near the front of the church, near the King family, and very close to those who were, and very near those who were closely associated with Dr. King. There was a strange mixture of emotions in that church. Sorrow, grief, sympathy, and then continuing anger, doubt, cynicism on the part of some. Yes, I recall some of the young blacks who would look at me, and I could see in their eyes that sense of, that feeling of bitterness and anger. And also, I thought I saw there, what's this man doing here? He doesn't represent me. He represents white America. And yet Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was one man who wanted America to be an integrated America. His brilliant and inspiring message on the occasion of the Freedom March in Washington, D.C. in 1963, where he spoke of his dream, was not an America that was divided by race or creed or color, but rather an America that was united in common purpose. An America, as he said, where his children would not be judged by the color of their skin, but the quality of their character. So this powerful message of this unusual man was the overwhelming force in the church that day. There were others that thought differently, to be sure. There were others that undoubtedly thought differently. Others that would not be forgiving. Others who knew, who simply couldn't stand this senseless act of murder and assassination. Indeed, no one could understand it. But the fact that it had happened was more than they could bear. How well I remember the music. Never had the choir of that church sang more beautifully. And I must get the name of the church, and I'll try to get a list of those who were the speakers and who gave eulogies. And we should add that part in here, so remind me to get that, or you get it. I'm sure that some of that must be in our files. Following the funeral service, there was a massive parade or walk down the streets behind the coffin of Dr. King. After all, it was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. who walked and led his people down the country roads of the South in the streets of Chicago and down the streets and boulevards of Washington, D.C. in that memorable Freedom March in August 1963. I recall so well that march and that occasion. I remember how everyone was so worried as to whether or not this pouring into the Capitol of thousands of people from all over the nation would result in violence and disorder. I remember full very well being asked by President Kennedy to make a see to it that he got a report as to the developments in the meeting, even though, of course, he was keeping a very close personal eye on what was transpiring and had others who were bringing him reports by the minute and the hour as to all that was transpiring. But the Freedom March was well organized. People came from every state in the Union, and they gathered together in Washington that morning. Get the date in here now. They gathered together in Washington that morning, meeting in churches and halls, preparing for the march that was to take place in the afternoon. We were to march down Pennsylvania Avenue and we were to march down Constitution Avenue up to the Lincoln Memorial, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others were to speak. I marched with our group from Minnesota. Alongside of me was my colleague, Senator Eugene McCarthy. We had met with our contingent from Minnesota over at one of the churches nearby the Capitol, and we had joined them for a bite to eat, and then on to the parade route. Over 200,000 people had come to Washington to demonstrate in behalf of civil rights legislation. The Civil Rights Leadership Conference had been in the forefront of the organization of this mass meeting. It was America on its feet, America on the move, America marching, and in the nation's capital city. The police were edgy. The city authorities were wondering what was to happen. But everything went well. People were in a joyful mood, not angry. They were demonstrating for political action, encouraging the Congress and the President to move forward with civil rights legislation. They were there to speak their mind and not to shake their fist. They were there in peaceful assembly, in the very highest tradition of the right of free speech and freedom to assemble. It was an amazing sight, an inspiring sight. I recall standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, looking out over that vast multitude. There were people everywhere that you looked, a sea of faces, and all of them fixed upon that symbol of emancipation, of freedom and democracy, the Lincoln Memorial. And it was in this setting, charged with emotion, patriotism, fellowship, and friendship, that Dr. Martin Luther King gave one of his most inspiring orations. I have a dream. And that message swept America. That one occasion did more to bring the truth of human rights and civil rights to the attention of the entire nation than anything that had happened than anything that had happened in the 20th, in all of our history. The president, President Kennedy, watched the developments. He received reports, and immediately after the great demonstration and speeches, he invited to the White House Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the other leaders of the civil rights movement for discussion and conference. In other words, Washington wasn't barricaded. It was not a fortress under siege. The White House was not turned into an island separated from protected and separated from the American community. It was all part of Washington and the White House, the Congress and the executive branch were all part of a great mass movement that day. And following following that huge and magnificent meeting, the leaders were brought to their house, because the White House does belong to the people. And there they were privileged to sit down and talk quietly with the president and some of the members of his cabinet and the congressional leaders. I suppose you could call this lobbying in its highest dimension, but I would call it the voice of America being heard and a response coming forth. From that day on, it was inevitable that the Congress of the United States would pass comprehensive, far-reaching civil rights legislation. The people had gathered in demand of reform, and the reforms were soon to come. And I have a feeling that in the congressional record following that meeting, following this demonstration, that I had some remarks, because I recall that I wrote up something. So I want to take a look at that, because what I had to say will most likely be much more precise and detailed than what I've been able to recollect here. So let's get somebody to look that up. During this tumultuous period of the 60s, and particularly after I became vice president, I tried to carry the message of the Johnson administration to all parts of the country. As vice president, I was assigned by President Johnson to be the contact with, the liaison officer, with all the local government officials. This included the mayors and councilmen, as well as the National Association of County Officials, city planners, tax assessors, and the many other organizations of local officials, including the National Association of Legislators. This assignment gave me the opportunity to work very closely with people at the local level and to learn a great deal about their problems and their needs. My work as mayor of Minneapolis gave me an entree into the National League of Cities and the United States Conference of Mayors, the two principal organizations that represented our municipalities. But I also had a fine working relationship with the National Association of County Officials National Association of County Officials. It was at one of their national meetings in New Orleans that I spoke out on the subject of poverty and what I believe to be some of the causes for the unrest that prevailed in our metropolitan areas. That speech in New Orleans brought me a great deal of criticism. my political opposition tried to infer that I was inciting people to riot and violence simply because I had stated that if I lived in a cold, dilapidated tenement house, if my child were bitten at nights by rats, and if I was without proper food and clothing, that I too might feel justified in joining in a riot. And then I went on to say, however, that violence does not settle problems. It only provokes more. However, I did feel it was necessary to say to the county officials, many of whom represented rural areas, that the conditions that existed in some of our city, that the conditions that existed in some of the central cities, in the ghetto areas of our metropolitan areas, were deplorable. They were an insult to the human body and spirit, to the human body, mind, and spirit, that they could not be condoned, that they did incite people to violence and disorder, that they were the festering grounds of crime and violence, and that something had to be done about it. My message was one of calling upon the local government officials to understand the problems of both urban and rural America, that the difficulties that plagued our cities were in part due to the unbelievable migration out of rural America into urban America, that there was what we call an urban-rural balance, and that when that balance got, and that when it got out of balance, that there were serious troubles. From the early 1940s into the 1960s, approximately 25 million Americans left rural America and came to the cities. The cities were poorly prepared to receive them, and the people that came knew little or nothing of urban life. Many of them were sharecroppers. Many of them were poor blacks and poor whites. People that came from the cotton lands of the South and from Appalachia. They came from the plains of the Midwest, and they came to the great cities, just as if they came to the great cities seeking better living conditions, jobs, and hopefully better income. But the cities were not ready to receive them, and the people that came were like strangers from a foreign land. To be sure, they were all Americans, but the America of Detroit was far different than the America of the rural countryside of Alabama or Mississippi. And the America of New York in the ghetto areas was far different than from the plains of the Midwest or the deserts of the Southwest. And yet the great cities attracted millions of fellow Americans, millions who were all too often poorly educated or not educated at all, people who left some of their families behind only to come to a place where they were strangers and no one to care for them. Thus, it was this kind of an America that was boiling with dissent and despair. An America that was at an explosion point. Now, Norman, I want to get the copy of that speech that I delivered at New Orleans and get the quote precisely and accurately, because this was one of the most controversial speeches that I had made. The period of the 1960s was very much like The Tale of the Two Cities by Charles Dickens. It was the best of times and it was the worst of times. There were trials and tribulations, and yet there were new hopes and aspirations. There was dissension, disruption, and destruction, and yet there was building and expanding and development.
All of this
taking place at the same time. Our college campuses were in an uproar. There were student demonstrations almost daily, and yet there were more young people going to college than at any other time in our history. Our secondary schools were in turmoil, and yet there were vast improvements in the educational programs that were being offered to our young people. Our cities were in turmoil and often in conditions of riot and destruction, and yet vast areas of new housing was being built. New parks were being planned and constructed. New factories were being built, and new job opportunities being offered. Thousands of young people were turning to drugs. And at the same time, our health facilities and health programs were being greatly expanded and made more available for millions of our people. Yes, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. It was America in conflict with itself, a nation that had not lost its way, but was desperately trying to find its way. A nation that had not had its best days, but a country that was looking for a way to find better days. I believe that Adlai Stevenson summed it up very well for us in one of his remarkable utterances when he outlined for us what he thought were the demands of democracy. He said, "Democracy is not self-executing. We have to make it work. And to make it work, we have to understand it. Sober thought and fearless criticism are impossible without critical thinkers and thinking critics. And such persons must be given the opportunity to come together, to see new facts in the light of old principles, and evaluate old principles in the light of new facts by deliberation, debate, and dialogue. This, as we all know well, though some of us forget from time to time, requires intellectual independence, impenitent, I-M-P-E-N-I-T-E-N-T, impenitent speculation, and freedom from political pressure, period. For democracy's need for wisdom will remain as perennial as its need for liberty. Not only external vigilance, but unending self-examination must be the perennial price of liberty, because the work of self-government never ceases," end of quote. In Adlai's noble style, in Adlai's brilliant rhetoric and noble style, we sense here the demands of democracy, and also the process that must be at work. And in the 1960s, we were not losing our democracy. We were testing it. We were not calling for an end to free government. We were insisting that it be expanded and enlarged. We were not putting down people's liberties. We were insisting that they be honored. But in all of this, there was unbelievable tension and turmoil. The times could best be characterized by words like dissent and demonstration, debate and dialogue, and destruction, yes, but also decision. All of this is part of the vital force and the growing pains of a free and democratic society. There were those who lost faith and those who gave up. And there were the critics, yes, the cynical critics, who said that our best days had been lived and that we were now on the downhill road, on the road downhill. There are even those that felt that we were incapable of coming to grips with the complexity of the times in which we lived and the multiplicity and complexity of the issues that confronted us. But there have always been people like that. These are people of faint heart, and more importantly, people who in themselves, who have lost confidence in themselves more than confidence in our society or social structure. This is not to minimize the difficulties, because the 1960s surely was a time of social upheaval and revolutionary ferment, and we would be foolish to underestimate its significance and the fact that it is a continuing revolution. But I think it ought to be remembered that America itself must be a continuing revolution. That is a revolution of, that is a process of change, of adaptation, of growth, and of expansion. And as Adlai Stevenson put it so well, there has to be intellectual independence, and there must be impenitent speculation and freedom from political pressures. He went on to tell us so beautifully in his magnificent language that there have to be critical thinkers and thinking critics. None of us who are in positions of responsibility or power enjoy this kind of cross-examination, this impertinent, the impertinence of some of our critics. But the whole process, the whole structure of our political and social order requires this kind of self-examination and this kind of continuing investigation and critical examination. It's only in this manner that we are able to shake off the barnacles of the past, or to scrape off the barnacles of the past, and to brush away the cobwebs of indifference and the corrosion of privilege and power that comes to those who are in what we call the establishment. But one ought to keep in mind that the establishment is always open to change and open to new members. And those of the 1960s who were the most militant dissenters have become now part of the new order, part of the new establishment. Some of them have been elected to Congress, others as mayors of cities, members of legislatures. Some of them have gone into industry and commerce, many of them into education and science. So that those that were in the vanguard and forefront of the change, of the spirit of change and militancy, are today the new leaders and the new members of a changing guard. I'm afraid that there's always a tendency on the part of people who have made it, who are the owners of property, the managers of industry, the leaders in a community, to resist change and to look upon those who advocate it as enemies and as dangerous people. But we ought to remember that America, but we surely ought to recall that the American heroes of our independence were people who dissented against the established order. They were people who spoke out against oppression. They were the men and women who demanded the right to govern themselves. And this spirit of the American Revolution continues to be a part of our national psyche, P-S-C-H-Y-E, of our national tradition. But it is a living tradition, expressing itself today, just as the preamble of the Constitution is written in the present tense. So the expression of natural rights, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, are not something of historical significance, but of a contemporary nature. They are the living embodiment of what we are and what we will be, not so much what we were. I addressed myself to this subject of the American descent in a speech at Williamsburg. And at this point in this book, that speech should be included, or excerpts from it, because it fits so neatly into this particular segment. So let's pull that in. During all this period of the tormented 60s, and particularly during the time that I was vice president, I was the spokesman for the administration and traveled widely throughout the country. Between the years 1965 and the end of my term as vice president in 1969, I'd spoken on approximately 100 college campuses in every part of the nation. And this was during the time when college campuses were in an uproar. There wasn't a single, I can hardly recall one instance where I was not greeted by hecklers, demonstrators. The fact is, there was more dissension and more demonstrations on college campuses than there were in the areas of the poor, in the ghettos of our central cities. And to many people, this was ironical and unbelievable. The college campus of the 1960s was like a country club. The young people in attendance were experiencing a lifestyle which was freer, more open, more undisciplined, more unregulated than at any time in the history of American education. Everything was available. Teachers, facilities, a wide curriculum, extracurricular activities of every conceivable kind, and yet there was unbelievable unrest, and yet there was tremendous unrest on the college campus. I'm sure that some of it was well organized and provoked by the so-called professional dissenter and militant, but also young people were upset. They were upset over the war in Vietnam, which they considered to be fruitless, useless, immoral, and unjustified. And I gather there must have been some sense of guilt, too, on the part of a number of young people on the campus, because many of them were there because those who were there were not subject to the draft or selective service. And some of these young people who were more active in their dissent and demonstrations than any of the young people who were outside of college. Actually, during the period of the 60s, the political commentator and an analyst who was attempting to tell the American people what young people were thinking was spending most of his or her time on the college campus. where the majority of young people did not actually were not to be found. The majority of young people were at work in factories and shops and filling stations and on farms or in the armed services. Or they were home, keeping house as a young wife. And many of them were in the community colleges and state colleges, which were less, which exhibited much less militancy and dissension than the larger universities and the private and the private colleges. It was interesting to note that many political calculations were made on the basis of commentators visiting a college campus only to find out that all of their polling and all of their speaking now about what was happening on the campus. As I was, college campus itself showed the division in American life. The vast majority of the students that were in college wanted to be there to get an education. To be sure, many of them did join in demonstrations, but this was an understandable phenomena. Young people tend to group together to follow a leader and to just gather around wherever there is any activity. But the beginning of the college of the university dissent was in the so-called free speech movement out at Berkeley at the University of California. Here was one of the truly great universities of America, and indeed of the world. The dissent was fueled not so much by the cause of free speech as it was by the objection to the war, and possibly by an inexplainable restlessness and revolutionary spirit on the part of a number of young people that seemed to come with the times. I've wondered many times just what was behind it all. Obviously, it wasn't economic distress for the young people, because the jobs were available, the country was never more prosperous, the rate of unemployment was never lower, inflation had not afflicted our economy. People were enjoying more luxuries than ever before, and particularly was this true of young people. The nation's attitude about youth had made a 180-degree swing. It was said in these days of the 60s that if you were over 30, you couldn't be trusted. And I do believe that many of the older members of the establishment bent over backwards to be accommodating to young people, and not only accommodating, but literally to let them run things and have their way. It was termed permissiveness, but I think in a real sense, it was just retreat and confusion. Those who were in charge of universities, of cities, of corporations, just didn't know what to do with this new, just didn't know how to handle this new form of militancy, and particularly a militancy that threatened the very structure, the legal and physical structure of our institutions. So rather than trying to understand it or even to resist it, many people just gave up and permitted it to take over. It's difficult to be critical of those who were in charge, however, because the choices were not easy. When students would occupy an administration building, it did little good to call in the police and have them thrown out, because it would be repeated all over again. And yet there were instances where students, and in some instances non-students that joined with students, not only would occupy a building, but would actually destroy expensive and costly facilities, particularly in laboratories and scientific, and particularly in scientific laboratories. What caused it all? Well, I'm one of those that believes that civilization goes through periods of almost indescribable change and revolt. Many people. Causes are many. The upheaval is the result of an accumulation of many aggravations, frustrations, and undoubtedly a breakdown of self-discipline and values. We saw all of this in the 60s. Every formalized institution was under attack. The church and religion, the home and the family, the college and the curriculum, the business structure and the labor movement, and every level of government. There seemed to be a flailing about, striking wildly at these institutions, and actually some of those who were leading the revolt and demonstrations frankly said that they had but one objective: to destroy that which is. When you would ask them, well, what do you seek to put in its place, they would respond again that this was not their concern. What they were interested in was destroying the established order, and that someone else would come along to build a new one. It sounds almost insane and ridiculous when one thinks back over this period and remembers what was said and done. But it was said. But these things were said, and the violence was everywhere, and the mob spirit seemed to grow. There is a sort of herd, what one can call a herd instinct, that is following a movement, joining up with it, never quite knowing why, but just being a part of it. And this was particularly true amongst young people. Now, looking back again at this period, you can see how the war was more of a catalyst than a cause. Many things had been gathering up over frustrations, and there was the black man seeking his identity, trying to stake out a place for himself in this so-called white man's society. There were the parents who were the children of the Depression that were determined that their children would not have to go through the trials and tribulations that they, the parents, had gone through. There isn't any doubt but what this group of parents that this group of parents of the Depression and World War II were overly generous with their children, yielding to their childish demands and their youthful excesses. Likewise, the young people did not have to face the prospect of being without a job or the misery of a depression. This was an unusual time, a period in which we were torn and divided, and yet prosperous beyond any, prosperous beyond the wildest dream of anyone 25 years before. It was a period of great population growth and expansion. It was a period of exploring and testing every single area of our life. It was a time when change was coming so fast that it was almost impossible to adjust to it. The television had come into its own and was obviously making a tremendous impact on society. It was the time of instant news and replay of the news. All the problems of the world were brought home, were brought into each home, club and tavern, every hour of the day, by radio and television. It was not only the printed word and the voice, but also the picture, the movement, the action. I doubt that any of us quite yet appreciates what the impact of the television and the electronic media has been upon the American mind and our lifestyle. But one thing is clear. People who had been accustomed to more or less hearing about their own local problems and at best the concerns of the United States all at once had become viewers of the world. They were tuned in, piped in to everything that was happening from a tribe and from everything that was happening from a faraway country in Africa to the street riots, to the riots, to the demonstrations and riots in Japan, to the incredible savagery of war in Vietnam, the hunger and famine in India, and the torturous and the constant dangers of the Middle East. There was no way to escape from it except to tune it out. And indeed, some people did just tune it out and tune off from everything that was going on. Such was the beginning of the hippie movement. The hippies were those who literally made a world of their own, broke away from the established order, cut themselves off from family, from the old value system that that had been so much a part of our country. They were the flower children, as they said, which was only another way of saying that they had broken away from the era of science and technology and organized society into a movement sort of back to nature. But the nature wasn't really there. It was the pavement and the asphalt. It was the grouping together of young people in communes and apartments, living their own life, whatever it was, such as it was, but above all, just breaking away from everything else that had been a part of their lives up to that moment. It was open rebellion, sometimes violent, sometimes a rebellion of total indifference and apathy. But call it what you will, America was the America of the 1960s was one that was torn and rent by forces that no one could quite comprehend or bring into check. On top of all of this was the war. And the war, in many ways, was a disaster. Surely, it was a disaster in this sense, that there were two Americas, not only the white and the black, that was noted so well by the Commission on Civil Disorders, but actually the America that was here at home, prospering, growing, expanding, and then the other America that had been shipped overseas to fight a war 10,000 miles, thousands of miles away from our coastline. The young men that were sent to Vietnam were in a sense like mercenaries. They'd been separated from their society, picked up by the Selective Service, sent off to fight a war that they didn't understand, that had not even been declared, in a faraway place that they knew nothing about, and in a culture that was totally foreign to them, and a culture and an environment that was totally foreign to them. And yet here were these young men, hundreds of thousands of them, and in the aggregate totaling into the millions, that were engaged in a brutal war, the likes of which we had never experienced before, and the rest of America was going along willy-nilly, was going along merrily at its own pace, enjoying the fruits of life as never before, engaged in self-indulgence, the likes of which we had never experienced. The nation was not on a war footing. There were no sacrifices asked of anyone, except those that went off to war and the families that gave up their sons. The taxes were not raised. There was no curbing of demand. There was no rationing, no price control. And there was no spirit of support or unity for the war effort. Compare this to World War II, when every civilian felt a part of the great struggle, when every civilian was called upon to be a part of the great struggle and felt very much involved, when people were willing to make sacrifices because there was a cause to be, there was a battle to be won, there was a battle to be fought and a war to be won and a cause to be achieved, and a cause to be supported, and a victory to be achieved. America was totally mobilized in World War II. Civilians were under rationing, price control and wage control. Civilian goods were limited in supply. Everybody knew that everybody was a part of the common effort. But in the war in Vietnam, the only people that were part of a common effort were those that were compelled to fight in the jungles and the rice paddies of Vietnam. The rest of America was enjoying a standard of living beyond anything that anyone had ever dreamed possible. And here were the young people who found out who were a part of this scene. Many of them knew that by going to college they could escape military service. And off to college they went in unbelievable numbers. Many of them were bitterly opposed to the war on principle. And I know of very few Americans that really enjoy putting on the uniform. And Americans don't really enjoy putting on the uniform. We are not a militaristic people. And the fact that Selective Service called upon some to do the fighting and exempted others from any responsibility or sacrifice was enough to tear a country apart. But strange as it seems, those who went off to war were not the protesters. Even when they came back, they were in many ways the forgotten young men of our time. They were in many ways the forgotten men of the decade of the 60s. It was those that stayed home that did the protesting and the rioting and the demonstrating. Some of them undoubtedly out of deep conscience, feeling that the war was morally wrong, politically unacceptable, and that we never should have been involved. But I can't help but feel that there were those that were protesting as a way of, that were protesting out of guilt or in the with a feeling that since they weren't in the war, they had to show that they were opposed to it. And many of them just joined into the general protest movement because it was the thing to do. And add to this the incredible permissiveness of the time, particularly at the college and university level, with the vast expansion of students and many students coming in that never ever before, and many students coming in from families that never before ever dreamed that they could send their young people off to college. We had an entirely different kind of student body. It was a student body that more clearly represented the total American public. It was not the student body of the 1940s and the 1930s and 1940s and even the 1950s, where the middle income and upper middle income groups primarily, or families primarily, sent their young people off to college. This was a student body that went far much, that went far deeper into the economic and social structure of America. And there could be no doubt that many young people went off to college, not so much to gain an education as to have an experience, to be with their contemporaries, and with the impetus of the selective service, bringing them to the college campus, thereby to avoid military service. With all of this increase in enrollment, there was a need for an expansion of faculty. And faculty members were drawn, and there was an expansion of faculty. Many of these new faculty members had as their life experience only that of going to school. They started out in preschool at age 4 or 5. And continued on through school without any other experience of any degree, of any marked degree, until they were in their late 20s and had achieved their doctor's degree and were ready to teach. These were the young men and women who were brought in to be the instructors, the assistant professors, the associate professors, and others of the burgeoning college enrollment. These were young men and women whose entire life experience had only been that of attending an elementary, secondary, or higher, whose only life experience had been in the elementary, secondary, and higher education field. They were not from the shops and the factories. They had not been off to war. They had not been steeled in or molded in the social fabric or in the fabric of our society outside of the school system. I mention this because I'm convinced that education, and particularly higher education, needs people who've had a breadth of experience and not merely the college experience. Some of them reminded me of a hothouse plant. It looked like a normal plant. It had all the colorations and structure of a normal plant, but it had not had to brave the storms and the uncertainties of weather and temperature, which the plant life of the field and the hills and valley had to endure in order to survive. So you had faculty that were more like the students than like the scholars, and then like the professors of old. There was faculty that sought to be popular with their students, rather than to be counselors, and to lay out standards of performance and conduct. All of this was a part of the scene of the 1960s.
And then?
Then too, professors as a group and college administrators are not accustomed to confrontation. And the 1960s was a period of political confrontation in every possible manner. American politics witnessed the rise of the heckler and the protest movement, the street marches, the banners, the profanity and vulgarity. And all of this came into the college campus just as well as in the political gathering. And college professors and college administrators were accustomed to the process of reason and of consultation rather than passion and confrontation. So they simply didn't know how to handle the situation, understandably so too. Hurried efforts were made to try to come to grips with the new frenzy and violence of the time. Students demanded to be on faculty committees, and those demands were met in many places. Students demanded to be on boards of regents and boards of trustees, and in some places those demands were acceded to. Students demanded to be able to judge faculty members and have something to say about their promotion, and in some areas this too was agreed to. Student groups were given the responsibility for many of the extracurricular activities and the non-academic activities of the colleges. The entire college curriculum was under re-examination. The words meaningful and relevant were used again and again. The question was asked, was this particular course relevant? Was this particular course meaningful? It's questionable what was really meant by these terms, but some of the student agitators were demanding was that the courses of study meet some of the immediate social, economic, and political needs or requirements of the time. The discipline of scholarship was given way to the immediacy of current events. And then there, of course, was the demand for ethnic studies, and particularly for black studies. Many universities hurriedly tried to put together courses that could be called black studies. Some of these were obviously of worth, but many of them really violated every rule of scholarship and educational excellence. But with all of the fury and all of the trouble and all of the commotion, American education survived and, I believe, and improved. Students were being treated more as mature young people, were to be treated as more as mature young people. The curriculum was re-examined. College professors that had been engaging primarily in writing and research were required to teach and to balance off their research with their teaching. Boards of trustees were made more conscious of the needs of students, and college administrators that had been spending much of their time raising money in order to support a university were required to listen to the grievances of professors and of faculty and students alike. The university system was not destroyed in the 60s. It was threatened, and at times it was in a state of complete confusion. But out of it came a university system, and out of it came a higher education system that was more responsive to the needs of the students, that was to play a better and more significant role in the life of the community, and that did take into account the pluralistic nature of the American society. Scholarship was not destroyed. Excellence in education, while it suffered for a considerable period of time, was restored, and the university system and then the system of higher education grew stronger and more open to more people than at any time in our history. In all of this period, the agitation was not just the product of the student and of student unrest. The agitation brought within its sweep agitators from outside of the college outside of the campus. America began to experience what some Latin American countries had known, namely the professional student, the student that just stayed on and on and on, never seeking to complete a course, never seeking to get a degree, but just to qualify as a student so that they could politicize the college campus and the university curriculum. This has been a curse to education in Latin America, and has regrettably produced a very inferior system of higher education in many of the Latin American universities, many but not all. The same sort of thing was beginning to develop at the American university and college level. Everything was being politicized: faculty, student body, curriculum, extracurricular activities. The college campus became a political hotbox, rather than a place for contemplation, study, scholarship, and reason. I believe that Kingman Brewster Jr., president of Yale University, put it very well when he said, "Even the most noble purpose cannot justify destroying the university as a safe haven for the ruthless examination of realities." Well, the 60s almost accomplished that destruction, but our great higher education system withstood the test, and universities returned to their primary function of providing for the ruthless examination of realities, of permitting men and women to study, to contemplate, to meditate, to excel in scholarship, to reason, and to think. It should be of some interest to note that the city colleges, yes, the great city colleges in most of our communities, were afflicted with less violence and disturbance than those that were islands of splendor and plantations of pleasure. For example, the great city colleges of New York did not find nearly the violence and the restlessness that seemed to afflict Columbia University or Cornell or Harvard or the University of Wisconsin, or the University of California, or many of the other great college campuses of our nation. I've often wondered why this was the case, and I suppose in part because those who attend city colleges are generally young people, who have other duties besides going to college. They are most likely working part-time. Some of them are older, coming back to college after having been out for some years pursuing an occupation. The typical college campus that's set aside from the community and becomes a sort of an island unto itself develops its own culture and its own sense of standards and its own lifestyle. In fact, I believe one of the mistakes of one of the problems that plagues higher education in all too many areas, all too many instances, is the fact that you create a youth culture. On the one hand, there is the faculty and the administration that sort of lives its own life, meeting together, working together, playing together, living together. And then there are the students. Yes, the students who live together in the dorms or in the housing projects that surround the academic temples of the college campus. This form of segregation on the basis of age is wrong. It promotes an identity which is totally unrealistic. It separates the youth not only from the older members of the community, but even more significantly from what's truly going on in the community around them. The segregation of the college campus itself has serious limitations and liabilities. But then to have segregated the youth within the college campus, both from the faculty and from the general community, and from their elders, only compounds the problem. Any form of segregation, to me, is wrong. We do exactly the same thing with our older people, with our senior citizens. We put them all aside in high-rise apartments, and they live together as senior citizens in their own kind of lifestyle, their own kind of environment. And they grow old faster that way, and they are more easily neglected, and they soon are tuned out from the rest of society. They are in a very real sense in a pleasant and beautiful compound, in a pleasant and orderly compound, removed and detached from the life that goes on elsewhere. The same thing happens to the college student, and to the college campus, where only the young live in the dormitories, where only the students gather together in the community, in the community halls. This kind of segregation produces a false sense of values and life experiences which are unrelated to what will be expected of the student once he leaves the college. Not only is it necessary for faculty and student to understand each other and to be in closer communication, but even more significantly, it is important that the student be a part of the world in which he lives and not set aside in some isolated, specialized surrounding that violates all the normal standards of life, which will be that student's experience once he or she leaves the country club atmosphere of the college environment. The role of the electronic media, and indeed the press in all of this period of turbulence, is one that demands very careful analysis and attention. It's exceedingly difficult to be objective about it, and really to be too knowledgeable. After all, while radio has been with us for about half a century or more, television is relatively new, its prominence in the media field spanning about a generation or 20 years. And yet television that carries with it the voice, the movement, the picture, and even color has a tremendous impact upon the mind and the emotions of people. And during the 1960s, it was the free press that did so much to forward the cause of civil rights and civil liberties. I recall that photograph taken by some skilled photographer showing a dog, a police dog, biting a black man as that black man had been clubbed into the ditch by the police. That one picture of a kindly elderly black man beaten down into the gutter by the clubs of a police officer and set upon by a ferocious dog did more to arouse America's feelings about the injustices perpetrated upon black people than almost any one expression or incident. So there was the picture and the caption and the story, in this instance in the printed press, flashing across the nation and capsuling in one photograph the agony, the oppression, the agony and the oppression of the black people, and the injustices being perpetrated upon them by people who were supposedly the guardians of the law. And obviously, the television had a tremendous impact in this period. Television can be a powerful instrument of education. It can also be a wicked instrument of propaganda. It can be the purveyor and conveyor of truth, or it can be the insidious conveyor of half-truth. It can bring the full story of what's happening to a country, a community, a group, or an individual, or it can bring a half story, a distorted image. Those who own, manage, or control the electronic media have a responsibility to society second to none. And it is a responsibility that is difficult to fulfill. There are always subjective judgments that have to be made in any kind of portrayal of what is known as the news. There just isn't sufficient time in the 24-hour period to give everything to project and portray everything that takes place. Therefore, there must be judgments made. And it's those who make these judgments that have in their hands awesome responsibility for what we call balanced news and fairness. During the 60s, we saw considerable emphasis upon great emphasis in the electronic media upon projection of the disturbances, the riots, the violence, the demonstrations. Now, to be sure, this was news, and these disturbances and demonstrations and riots were an expression of what was happening in America, and they needed to be brought to the attention of the American public. And this the television, electronic and media and the print press did in a generous and generous and substantial fashion. But there were those that wondered whether or not there was not too much emphasis, too much time given to a handful of demonstrators who knew that the television cameras would be there or that the reporter would be on hand. There were many instances in which a small group of protesters would get the large share of the attention in the evening newscast. And yet, who was to be the censor? Surely not the government. And surely no one would want someone appointed by the networks to be the censor. The judgment had to be one of the newsroom. And that judgment at times was not always all it should be. As long as there was competition, however, amongst the news, amongst the media, there was the chance to get some balanced projection of what was taking place in America. But there were instances that I can recall that signified some of the problems that we had. The coverage of the Freedom March by the networks, by the television and radio networks, and the free press was nothing short of a major, nothing short of a magnificent demonstration of what we mean by the free press. It's to the everlasting credit of our uncensored press and the institutions of freedom